The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Hello.
Hello, I'm here. Are you here?
I'm here too, and I see a sound level. So.
Okay, so we're on the air. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for hanging around. We had a little problem with our sound dropping as we started because somebody had called in while we were before the show started. And so that caused the problem with the sound. So we'll see if it changes now, but you should be hearing me. If anybody doesn't hear me, don't send me an email because I also don't have my email available tonight. But let me start and say good evening to you all. I'm very glad to welcome you to tonight's Heretics Hour on December 3rd, 2012, coming to you live via the White Network. The call-in number for tonight's show is 1-830-443-4911. If you want to write that down, it's 1-830-443-4911. And as I already said, I don't have any email tonight, but you are welcome to call. And it happens sometimes. I'm sorry about the email, but what I do have with me, as I've already indicated, and he's already been talking, is Tan Stoffel on board tonight. So I'll get right to him. Hello, Tan.
Hi, Carolyn. Glad to be here. That's my crappy software that's failing.
Yeah, well, you don't get around to looking into these little things that are these funny little things, and I can understand that because there's always so much to do. So I don't know what to do about that stuff when that happens. But anyway, we're on our way here. So what we're going to talk about what's happening at the White Network and how we're feeling about it, sort of. And I would say that I'm not in as expansive a mood as I was 3 months ago when we talked before, and let me remind people that we did do that show back on, did I write it down here? Anyway, it was August 27th that we did a show I called it Progress Report. So I'm calling this one Progress Report too, and we're gonna discuss a lot of things like about the White Network, but also about the white movement and what we think and what we think maybe some ideas of what should be done and what we see happening and all of this. So you want to start out, Tan, and give some thoughts of your own?
Sure. I had two things really that I wanted to talk about as far as the progress report goes. And that's, first of all, the program that I've been doing and how I feel about that. And some reaction to the election of 2012, since I didn't have any time to produce a blog post as I would have in the past. I'm very happy, happier than I thought I would be in producing radio programs installments for a radio program. And it's not the same type of program that you produce. It's not live, and it's only 30 minutes. But it makes me happy. The first half of the shows that I've done so far have been pretty easy for me to put together from a information point of view because it was already stuff that was in my head and I really was just reviewing and regurgitating things that I had already thought through. It was hard because I had to learn the skills of speaking and organizing my thoughts for speaking. And then the second half, I've spent more researching things that I had always been curious about and maybe knew a little bit about, and I knew were related to what I wanted to talk about, and fleshing out things that I had sort of taken for granted, like the idea of whiteness, white identity. And it's been very interesting. That's even more rewarding for me. I think the first half of the shows that I did, I hope, were rewarding to people, certainly people who are new to all of these ideas and to white identity and the Jews, that I hoped explained some things in good terms, in fair terms. And that in the second half, that the people who get value out of this are going to be the people like me who are only peripherally aware of these things and maybe were curious about them and are finding out something that they didn't know, like I am.
Well, that's right. You know, what we need for your shows is to get them out there as much as possible, because they are very good for the very kind of people you're talking about. Especially good for those who don't know a lot of this and can listen to this non-threatening, the later shows you've been doing, non-threatening kind of discussion about what is white, who is white, and what it means. And I think your last program, last Tuesday's, was, I liked especially much because you started talking then about the kind of thing you're so good at, which is how they don't want us to talk about ourselves and don't want us to think about ourselves as a group and as white and so on. And
they don't want us to use the tactics that they use to great advantage to themselves. Yeah.
Well, that's it. I think that is probably the most important thing that we have to say as whites, and the most important thing we have to get across to other white people. And I think it's very difficult, because I had this thought just last night, I think it was, that that people, don't like to change, don't like change very much, and they will. I was thinking about Obama, and thinking that if people. It struck me that if he could run a third time, you know, if we didn't have this two-term limit on presidents, he would probably win again. And then he'd probably win the fourth time. I mean, the longer you win, look at FDR.
President for
got
life.
Four terms. And people would have kept voting for him, because by then they thought nobody else could do it but him if he hadn't gotten in such bad health. And then, of course, he died, thank goodness. But look at the congressmen and the senators. So many of them, they just keep being reelected, even though they're really not doing a good job, but people will vote for what they know. And in the same way, I think in politics generally, or in political thought, people have gotten used to living amongst other people, you know, non-white people. And I think for a lot of people, they would feel very strange if suddenly to even consider that there would be nothing but white people around them and everybody else would not be there, that they would think that was would be boring or dull, you know, or lacking in opportunities or something, because they've gotten used to that. And it's very hard to change people's habits.
Well, and they're not just coming up with that idea that it's boring and white bread and all of that on their own. That's the message that they're receiving from the mainstream media and from the universities. That's what they're teaching kids in school.
Magazines, everything, books. You're right. But once they get that in their head, of course, if you could get rid of all of that, people would change back again, or, you know, would get changed back to more normal thinking. But this is a real challenge, because they have control. These people who are doing this have control of the entire network of, it's not a network, what is it? Have control of the social, of the, well, the communication industry in every single way. So it's very hard to know how to go about this. And as we are going to kind of get into a little bit, we're so divided. Our cause, pro-white people, are so divided on so many things. that even if we had the best plan in the world, and I think I have some good some good ideas. It's how do you get people to all go along with it? Because I think we need to have a united front. At the same time that I say, well, I think we need to have a united front, I think it's almost impossible that we're going to have one.
Yes.
So that's why I'm kind of depressed a little, and I think after this election, a lot of people are. But when I talked about not being in such an expansive mood, I was talking about the white network, and it wasn't that I'm not all still as happy about it, but that by expansive I meant as to make it grow, you know. I was all set to make it grow, and we did get two new shows, and now they're both gone in that in the course of 3 months. So that's another thing that we're going to address. But let's go on with what you – I wanted to make that correction so people wouldn't think that I was, you know, really negative tonight. But why don't you go ahead with what you want to say about the election, because that's what I kind of brought us to also.
Well, sure. I had the major and the first point that I would make is a very simple one, and that is that race matters. This is the takeaway for white people from the election of 2012 is race matters. And the reason that's such a significant point to make is because – white people have been told for decades now that race doesn't matter. That's what this brainwashing or this message that's coming from the media and from the schools is has been telling them, is that and to the extent that race does matter, it shouldn't matter. You know, even if there are things where it does still matter, that it shouldn't. And what they did was they woke up on the morning after the election of 2012 and heard, or even the night of the election, they could hear these mainstream pundits who otherwise never talk about race, never talk about things in racial terms, were talking about the election in purely racial terms, black and white and Asian and Latinos, you know, our new overlords. This is nothing new to anyone who's been paying attention from a racial point of view, but it is new to the ordinary white Americans, the vast majority of white Americans who have accepted the idea that they shouldn't think of themselves as white, that that's not important, and that it's – and if they try to think of themselves in terms of who's white and who isn't, what's good for white, that that's bad, that's evil, and that they should feel guilty about doing that. And the people who do it are monsters, you know, the David Dukes of the world or the Adolf Hitlers, you know, those – we don't want to be like those people. That was one of the major takeaways, and I think it, regardless of how many white networks are out there and how many people we're reaching, the mainstream media were telling white people that race matters. They weren't saying that, hey, you white people should start thinking about what's good for whites. That's what we have to tell whites, and hopefully that message will get through. The media was busy telling white people that, you know, you're has-beens, you're out. The Latinos, the Asians, they're in. And you should just give up and surrender. Because, oh, by the way, you know, we have been telling you it's not about race, and we were just joking. We were just fooling you. It was all a fraud. And white people, like when you had Kevin MacDonald on, I thought that was a great interview, and he made a great point about being angry. And white people should not just be angry. We should be outraged. It's a moral outrage, the way we've been swindled, the way we've been defrauded.
He understands that, and I was going to say that Kevin MacDonald is one of the ones who I would say has had the right kind of reaction from the election. A lot of people just say, well, what do you expect? You know, it's an electoral process. I never paid any attention to it anyway. Nobody should be voting. And, and you know, I can see the wisdom in that, too. But this election did show us, is what you were just saying, how much race matters in this country. But it's kind of like when they're not saying race doesn't matter now. They're saying, okay, you know, but race, the white race doesn't matter, or race doesn't matter when it comes to white people. We don't want to hear about white people in our racial discussion. We just want to hear about colored people.
And when they say diversity is our greatest strength, they're not lying. They're telling the truth. Diversity is their greatest strength. It's our mistake to interpret them as meaning everybody's.
And who is they? Who is they? You know,
well, it's non-whites, and with the coalition being led by the Jews, of course. Yeah, and that's
the
second big takeaway is Jewish power and the undeniable strength that and influence that Jews have.
Well, right, because when I look at it, of course, I don't look at it from the normal standpoint, I guess, but, you know, I just see clearly, well, you know, this has all been engineered by Jews, and these other people have just learned how to do this and have had all this success because of the Jews behind the scenes, and they're becoming more prominent. I think Jews are becoming more prominent and more out front, more open about themselves. Do you think so?
Yes, I do. And I would say you don't even have to argue about how it happened or who did it, whose fault it is. Let's just start with the observation that they have incredible power, that both political parties pander to the Jews, and what the Jews think is important and what's best for the Jews, they fall over themselves. I watched all the debates, and I watched the election night results, as you said, not really caring how it was going to turn out one way or the other. And then, like most of my ordinary friends who do root for one side or the other, was kind of shocked by the outcome when it came out anyway. But the Jewish power is pretty naked, and we can leave the discussion of how it happened and who's to blame for it as a separate issue. But it should be clear to everybody that the Jews have enormous power, and in that sense, they're not white. I've been leading to this point in my series of programs that drawing the distinctions here between Jews and whites. And while they're a Caucasian people, they are a genetically distinct people, and politically they're 180 degrees different from whites. They don't vote like white people do, in all of the polls showing how the majority of whites voted for Republicans and not as many voted for Democrats, and the Republican Party is the white party. Well, Jews voted 70-odd% for the Democrat, for Obama. In that sense, they're not white, and the political limitations too of whites not being able to talk about what's best for whites. There's that stark difference there too, that it's white people that can't do that, not Jews. Jews can talk openly about what's best for Jews, and that's a morally good and sane thing to discuss, whereas it's the exact opposite for whites.
Well, considering what the election taught us, and let's say we didn't need to be taught, but the American people can see what the results were, and how racial everybody voted. Although I don't know how many people give a darn what the breakdown is of how different races voted. You know, we pay attention to that, but I wonder how many ordinary white Americans have even thought about it.
Well, it was thrust in their face in this election. In 2008, you're right, it wasn't in the mainstream. You could dig for those numbers, and I remember I did, and that was my post-election post in my blog, was an analysis of that and how whites were being pathologized and demonized as racists, and we were actually, of all the racial groups, the least biased, the least skewed, whereas every other group was more skewed in favor of Obama. And it's the same, pretty much. It's a repeat with a few differences this time around. The big difference is that the media is thrusting it in everybody's face. And there's all sorts of end zone dances going on the other side, on the non-white side, celebrating their great victory in terms of race, in terms of, hey, the white people are vanquished now. You know, it's not a post-racial society. It's a post-white society now. And they'll, you know, a lot of the white Republicans are starting to grapple with the fact that there may never be another white guy on the ticket, president or vice president, from this point on.
That's right. That idea is dawning probably on the people who matter most, because they're the most politically active people. And the people who aren't politically active particularly probably don't matter as much. Well, then, can we go from here to how we in the pro-white people should deal with this? What ways that we would have to proceed against it? Do you have some ideas on that? Or,
well, I try to do what I would recommend, which is I talk about white identity. I try to instill that. I try to give people the confidence to think about it and talk about it themselves by example. And I think the second point I mentioned, the second takeaway from the election about the Jewish power, is not as blatant and is not in your face. You don't have mainstream commentators saying, oh, after this election, we can see how powerful the Jews are. It's more of an implicit thing in the fact during the debates, for instance, you see the two candidates having a debate over who is going to more forcefully and more thoroughly defend the interests of Israel, or who's a better friend with Bibi. That makes you want to puke as a, even just if you were a patriotic American that had, you know, denied it had anything to do with race, you know, your typical Tea Partier has got to be thinking, why are they arguing about what's best for Israel? Isn't this a race for president of the United States? And, you know, it's going to make some of them think. I mean, that's ultimately how I got where I am, is those kind of strange things. And it, especially if you've got people like us pointing it out in a sensible way that explains the mystery, then people will, it may take a couple of times, they may kick and scream and call you names in reaction at first, because they don't want to hear it and they don't want to think about it. But eventually, most people come around. Maybe not most. Half of the people, in my own personal experience, amongst my own friends and relations, probably half the people, roughly half the people, shut down and never start up again. They don't want to talk about anything that might even lead to that kind of a realization again with me, to the point of cutting off communication with me. But the other half say, you know, I never thought about it that way. And, you know, they're open-minded, and I have further conversations with them over the course of weeks and months. And most of them, ultimately, I can talk completely openly in the same way I would talk with you about politics and race and Jews. They don't necessarily start those conversations themselves, but they don't run away screaming either. So I think there's some hope in.
Well, that's good, and that's very interesting, because you still have a circle, a large enough circle of friends and acquaintances and family that you communicate with, whereas I mostly communicate now to people on the internet and to people that are involved in this, and I don't go out in, you know, in the community, and I don't see that many people to go out and talk to them about these things. I've already talked about my sister-in-law that I talked to, but I come at this from the idea. See, you're coming from a, probably the best way is what can I personally do. And everybody needs to do that. Everybody needs to think about what they personally can do. I tend to think, what can we do as a group? What can we do as a pro-white movement? Or, and I've already talked about how I don't think we're a movement. But and one thing I come up with is that the first thing is that we need to understand how the Jews operate. And we need to even understand that clearly ourselves. And then, and I don't know who this we is, you know, this is where it gets difficult, but, and a point, here's what I think we could do that would, in which we would operate the way the Jews do. This, I know what I'm saying here. I'm saying that the way the Jews operate is that they have a united, they do have differences, but they still, get behind, what's going on, and they do follow through on what they're supposed to do and say what they're supposed to do, and they support their Jewish organizations, and they kind of know who's who and what's what, and there's a lot of dumb ones who don't, but they go along with whatever. They follow what other people are doing in their synagogues and so on. But so they operate in this way. Well, I'm actually thinking of what's written in the Protocols of Zion and as a plan of how to proceed, you know, that is, goes back a ways. Well, I think we need to be able to operate in that same way. And to do that, the only thing we could do would be, at this point, would be to appoint a committee of wise men and women. And I include the women there. And you have to have some women. You can't just have only men, I think. But if they really did the job well, it would be all right. Who will function similarly to that and will create a plan to undermine and remove Jews from power in our midst. And, you know, why can't we do that? Why, if we really have a movement of some kind, or serious people, why can't they get together, the certain ones, who would be, and this would be difficult too, but who would be really, serious, who would be wise enough, who would be committed to working together and come up with a plan that could be carried out against the Jews the way the Jews have a plan against the whites.
Well, it's been tried. I'm no expert in the white racialist movement and its history, but from what I do know, part of the reason that Metzger, for instance, believes now in leaderless resistance and small cells or even just lone wolf type activity is because the attempts to create larger organizations, and I can think also of Revelo Oliver's experience with the Birchers, have been subverted, taken over, destroyed, sued out of existence. Anytime we try to organize as a group that's operating openly, we are attacked.
Well, I'm thinking of it kind of like a Bilderberger type thing, where people are invited.
Yeah.
And it's a secret place. It's supposed to be secret, and things leak out. But it that they would do this and get together and come up with something. And I mean, this takes real seriousness. And if you're gonna, I don't know that Tom Metzger had the right idea or anything. It's kind of like the white ADL idea that we came up with in a previous program when you were on. But it would have to be secret and very, very serious.
Well, it also requires a white identity. It requires people who have some agreement that they are a group and that that group has is very important to them, means life or death.
That's right.
Them, that they're willing to, maintain secrecy and give their all to it. And honestly, I don't think that we're there as a group. And that's partly my approach has been to talk about the tactics that have been used against us and to point to these things like the fraud, for instance, of being told that race doesn't matter only to find out that it does. Objectively, it does. Now, anybody who's been a racialist their whole life goes, duh, well, you're an idiot for not seeing it through that from the beginning, and you deserve to be culled out of the white race. Well, maybe I do. But there are a lot of people like me and a lot of people that can wake up. They need to have these things pointed out to them and how it works. And once they see the mechanics of it, there can be a sort of – it's like a rubber band being wound up and then snapping. There's all this energy that they've invested in misleading us and defrauding us can have a blowback to it if we trigger it, if we show people that it was a fraud, if we show people that they've been lied to and misled, and we give them the explanation that's the truth as to how they were misled to their own disadvantage. That will create an identity in them. They try to – this is a good example of them trying to tell us that one of the tactics that would be most successful for us is just wrong, it's stupid, it's crazy, it's evil, and that is the idea of having an other as a scapegoat for us. It's they use the word scapegoat in the wrong sense. A scapegoat literally is when you take problems and you blame them on somebody who's actually blameless, and you thereby cleanse yourself or transfer the blame from where it really belongs to somebody it doesn't belong. They always claim that we're trying to scapegoat them when we simply try to hold Jews responsible for what Jews do, or any non-whites. Then they start screaming about stereotyping and scapegoating. And the reality is that it's white people who are generally being scapegoated in this society. All the ills of society, all the ills of the world, and the United States especially, blamed on white people. When white people come to that realization, whether it's because we tell it to them or because they figure it out on their own, a rubber band snaps in their brain, and then all of the brainwashing from that point on doesn't work anymore. In fact, it has the exact opposite effect. Once people see the manipulation being done, they resent it, and it has the opposite effect. And that's what worked on me.
Well, I agree. You're right. You're right. And a lot of that, that's the way it works. I just think we should have make a concerted effort, also with some, people who should be the smart enough people, but I don't know if any of these people can ever get along, even in a committee, because they would have to come from different areas in the so-called movement, and make out a plan in which to to target certain things. This is the way the Jews operated, and look how successful they were. To expose what they're doing to as many ordinary people as possible. And I think that all people are never going to do this, because I think that white people, as I realized, are the reason that we've been as successful, the reason that we are responsible for most of the achievements and the inventions on this planet, and we consider ourselves the greatest race, even though we seem to be unable to keep our survival going, is because we are an individually creative people. We are free thinkers who follow our individual inspirations. And for a long time that worked, because we didn't have any real enemies in our midst except ourselves, our own people. And, yes. You know, I give like Henry Ford as an example. You know, what a great example of a man with a certain genius, and he was free to do what, follow his own ideas, and look what he accomplished. So, but at the same time, we have to have some, you know, we're a target, you know, we're wide open for what's happened to us. So we need to develop some kind of a group that would be like the fighting, you know, some that are willing to give up everything for this, to give up their own personal lives and so on, and be a part of this. Well, they might not have to do that, but they would, you know, devote themselves to this job that they had to I don't know what I would call it, but to this kind of a committee thing of wise men who would do this work for the rest so that the rest can live.
In William Pierce's Turner Diaries, it was the Order.
Okay. I didn't read those.
Yeah, well, that was the wise secret committee that made the decisions.
Okay, well, there's a good example of
it. But one point I wanted to make about what you said about us being individualistic is there is some evidence of that in digging into the biological roots of the white race, the European peoples. There is a history of mixture there. We have at the very least two stocks of people, the people who originally settled Europe, and then there are the Aryan peoples, who were sort of a separate branch that had branched off earlier and gone into Central Asia and then eventually invaded Europe. And they had two different characters to them, two different mental descriptions. The people who were sort of, call them the natives of Europe, were more individualistic, hunter-gatherer types that had a more maternalistic attitude and a share-one, share-all type of mentality, and against aristocracy, whereas it was the Aryans who brought this paternalistic and might makes right. And mostly what a lot of racialists see as the best qualities of the white race brought that to Europe. And the two are fused together, and you see it popping through in different aspects of our personality. The classic liberalism that came from the Anglo-Saxons, that came from England to America and founded the United States, and this idea of all men are created equal, that's an example of that shining through. But you know what? While I can understand those arguments and I can see a sort of biological substrate to what we do, I don't think it determines that we should be sheep led to slaughter or cows to be led to slaughter because of that. Because as you say, being aware of it, we should be able to compensate for it. And I also know that in World War II, for instance, where we had this horrible fratricidal war, when the Jews took the leashes off and let us go at each other, we are very, very creative and very, very innovative at killing and destroying when we need to be. And this is part of what I go back to what I said about the other. When we can identify an other and the leash is off and we're allowed to do whatever we have to do to destroy that other, we're pretty good, damn good at it. Just as we are good at creating and building. So there is hope. We just have to
identify who the other is. We have to see this enemy. We have to
stop mistaking ourselves for the other. I mean, we have these murderous feuds amongst ourselves. And meanwhile, here is this manipulative race exploiting us. and telling us that we're the exploiters, telling us that we're the bad people, that we're the evil manipulators, and we're the evil colonists, colonizers, and oppressors. It's infuriating when you see
it. You know, a lot of where do I have that? Let's see. I put that way down here. A lot of what is being said amongst our people against one another has been formed by this Jewish world plan that's been going on. And there's this fellow Thomas 777, and I think he might be somebody that Hadding argues with on the fora at times, because I think I saw him there a long time ago. But he said some good things here recently to people who were attacking Christianity. And this is, you know, he said, let's see if I can find the exact thing. He said there seems to be a blind spot among white nationalists with respect to Christianity. For some reason, it doesn't occur to you people that maybe the Jewish-dominated academy, media, and judiciary isn't presenting Christianity in an accurate light, but rather is aiming to neutralize what remains of it as a cultural force. Says the fact that Jews and Shabbos Goy careerists claim that Christianity is about tolerance, feminism, open borders, pacifism, and Tower of Babel globalism, Babel should be, ought to signify to you that actual historical Christianity is probably entirely opposed to these things. Well, he says some other things, but I think that's a point that those who decide they don't like Christianity then look for the very worst things they can say about it, and portray it in those ways that those who are either like Christianity or are more tolerant of it can see a different side of it that these other people don't want to even recognize. So, and this has been played up. You know, he's right. This has been played up for us by our enemy, which is the Jew, basically, and we've fallen for it. So,
yeah.
I was going to bring up here that, you know, these the differences that whites, because you brought it up real good, that we fight against amongst ourselves.
Well,
and this is the first one. Yeah, the divisions. Religion is the first one.
There's an element of truth to all of our divisions, and Christianity and religion is one of them. The division between Protestant and Catholic is another. But they don't. You know, whether they created them or whatever, or the total thing, I don't think that they're 100% behind it. But they do definitely amplify and accentuate those differences. It's a basic strategy of divide and conquer.
Well, I think it's definitely true that the basic Jewish plan is to destroy Christianity. It's not Christianity is not a part of that. Well, I've talked about that. I don't want to cover that ground again. But But
they've neutered it. At this point, they can live under it, just like previously they had done the same with Islam and could live under Islam and even thrive under Islam. They've done the same with Christianity at this point. It's a different animal after Vatican II than it was before, and then certainly centuries ago. There was a time when Europe and Christianity were
equated. But this is the kind of
equated.
Christianity that these white nationalists object to, the neutered kind.
Yeah, and
while
to it too,
while I realize, know. Yeah, I realize that there's a lot of excess among some Christians, but I would think that we should be able to, to get past religious differences really and talk about racial things, but they will insist, well, you can't get to race because Christianity is totally non-racial. You know, it's totally multiracial, and it's not going to change.
Yeah,
and
that's true. It's one of the many things. It creates a certain pacifism in our people, but it's
it didn't
in the way.
Always. It doesn't have to. It depends on how you interpret it. I think.
Yeah. True. And there's another element here, which is the fact that it's passive makes it easy to attack Christianity, and I think. You know, if you've got a variety of things that might be the cause, it's easy to blame white people. It's even easier to blame Christians. They won't fight back, at least not today's Christians. So there's a little bit of a shooting fish in the barrel thing to it that turns me off, and that's why I don't engage in it myself, and I see the Jews as being a worthy target for criticism, more worthy than Christianity is.
Well, but other people don't. Other people spend all their time going after Christianity. See, and I just can't see how that is ever going to get us anywhere. So this is a serious division that is a problem, and the fact is, there's a lot in Christianity that is fighting. There is a fighting spirit in Christianity, but it's been kind of killed, or it's been kind of washed over, or it's ignored, and the other is pushed. And I think a lot of this is that same manipulation by the Jews, and we're falling for it. I think some of our people use arguments against our people that are really coming from the Jews. This is kind of what Thomas 777 was saying. And we need to look at that and find ways to because even if there's a lot of Christians who are too willing to get along with non-whites, they're still white people that we have to consider. I mean, we can't, what are you going to do? Kick them out? I mean, what are you going to create a cause without all these people? How about some more? The second one, gender. Then there's a lot of problem between male chauvinism, which has come up at the White Network, and sensitivity to or rejection of feminism, making some of these men, that's all they talk about is feminism.
Yeah, well, I see it. Well, first of all, the white race can't exist without both men and women. We need both. We don't have the technology to get along with just one or the other yet, and it wouldn't be good probably ever to do away with one or the other. But it turns me off. The men's rights movement is sort of the reaction to feminism, and I don't like either. And I see that there similarly, it's an escape to talk about gender differences because you don't want to talk about the racial differences, which are more taboo and more consequential, really. As bad as white women's grievances against men might be, or white men's grievances against white women, it just pales in comparison to the grievances we both have together against other races and what they're doing to us.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of men, they would rather talk about women because they think women are less powerful.
It's an easy target.
Yeah, easy target. Exactly.
It's a little bit more politically incorrect for men to criticize women, but it's becoming more and more politically correct. There's this whole men's
amongst
rights.
Some of these, on these forums and comment boards and so on.
And they see the entire world through that prism
terrible.
Of men versus women. And it's like most other of these competing worldviews, they ignore race. They do it almost as a way to ignore race. It's an excuse to not talk about race, is to blame everything on sex differences. There's a commenter that's famous on the blogosphere, or the racialist blogosphere, especially at Steve Saylor's site. His name is Whiskey. And people joke that he's Scots-Irish. He claims to be Scots-Irish, and they use Scots-Irish as a euphemism for Jew, because everybody recognizes his arguments as he's constantly defending the Jews, and he's constantly trying to recast things in which the Jews are involved instead in terms of men versus women. And, you know, it's really those white women that are to blame for getting Obama elected. You know, it's not the Jews. It's mm-hmm. white women that are to blame. That's a typical Whiskey type of argument. And he's not alone. There's lots of people who are making...
Well, a lot of them... say that they put women in the class with non-whites and Jews. They do. They put and minorities or whatever, you know, women because the Jews have managed to classify women as a minority and give them all these, you know, special attention and rights and so on, like the other minorities. And women are say, I don't know what women, I don't know how big a part women had. Of course, feminist women, most real feminist women are Jewish women. You know, then they pick up a few that aren't Jewish, but certainly feminism, when it started, was all Jewish women.
Well, second wave and third wave feminism, yeah. But initially it was white women that were...
Well, you're talking about women's liberation.
I'm talking about
that's
suffrage,
not feminism. Yeah. I don't call it.
You could consider that first wave feminism. It's maybe what would be called feminism by some men's rights.
Well, that wasn't so offensive. Those women just wanted to vote. They were doing a lot of good work, actually. But they were doing a lot of good anti-war work during previous to World War II. But it was the real feminism that started, you know, in the 60s.
The poisonous
the Jews,
and sick feminism was Jewish feminism. Yeah.
Right. And so then we also have something that affects us so much at the White Network is inclusion of non-whites as allies and partners. For example, Jews like Paul Gottfried is considered, you know, one of us or something. Gilad Atzmon is so popular. Everybody loves him because he's anti-Israel. But he's critical of Israel, but actually he has said he thinks there should be an Israel. So he's not so anti-Israel. I don't know what he's anti-right-wing Jews. He's anti-everything right-wing. He's anti-war and all that stuff. And then Brother Nathaniel, we've talked about in the past, you know, who's a Christian convert. So all these people get a pass because of these things that about them, but they're still Jews. And then there's some non-whites. Well, these are non-whites. There's other non-whites. I'm not going to mention this one I have written down here. But
it starts with Jews. It started historically with Jews. They were the first non-whites that whites were told were equal citizens in our countries back with Jewish emancipation 200 or so years ago. And from there, it branched out. It was really the Jews generalized their own narrative of victim group, victim class, minority. They were the prototypical victim class and 200 years ago. And then they generalized that to women, and they generalized it to Negroes, and they generalized it to homosexuals. And now they're generalizing it to Muslims and beyond. That's how it works. That's the ideological structure behind it.
Well, that's why we should. Now, that's the area where I think we could get started with education of people is going back to that Jewish emancipation. Yeah. I know that Kevin McDonald has done all that good work in that, but there's plenty to read about it. But should be talked about more how they did that. And what they had in mind and what it ended up being and what they, you know, what the results were.
Well, let me plug something I did, which is back in February, just before we started in earnest on the radio stuff. I wrote a blog post called The White Guide to the Jewish Narrative. And I pretty much summarized how it all fits together, at least as how I understood it at the time. And it hasn't changed much since then. The work that I've done on my program, Age of Treason Radio, is really just fleshing out what I summarized and gave an outline of in this White Guide to the Jewish Narrative. It's what's going on and how it happened, who's doing it, and why they're doing it. And that's what I'm trying to basically create some foundation for now. I mean, I had, through 5 years of blogging, built a sort of series of bits of evidence of names and places and events that I had discussed and educated myself on and shared with people who came to my blog. And then this was the culmination of it, where I laid it all out in a, you know, without quoting anybody else or anything, just describing how I thought it went. And then the radio show is really just talking about those elements in a little bit more detail and going into some of the roots a little bit deeper than I did in that thing. But
yeah, you call that White Guide to what? I remember
White Guide
that.
To the Jewish Narrative. And it,
okay.
I tried to fit all the puzzle pieces together and give a view.
See,
of the
we
whole
should
puzzle.
Probably we should probably have that printed up in a pamphlet and mail it out to a big mailing list. I don't
this
even
is,
have a very yeah, big mailing list.
I'm not very big on repetition and self-promotion, and you're right. I invested the effort to create that, and I think it's one of my better pieces of work. And I should refer to it more often. I haven't even referred to it in the radio show. It wasn't until tonight, thinking about what we'd be talking about and how I could summarize the work I've been doing, that it occurred to me that this was really, without thinking about it, a preview, a summary of what my radio show, at least initially, was going to cover. And it is a pretty good summary of my worldview of what's happened, what I figured out.
Well, there you go. You know, I think there's a lot that we all do that we look back and we forget about it, you know, in the general everyday thing. And there's always new stuff to read and new stuff coming out. But there's a lot that we've done that we should do more. We should do more with it. We should make it work for us better than we do.
I find myself reminding myself that, and I still don't do a good job of it, even though I remind myself, is that repetition is not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
When you hit on something that works, you should repeat it, and you should simplify it and try to get other people to start understanding and echoing it themselves.
And okay, we can talk about that more, I hope, in the second hour. Right now, let's finish this. Well, we still have some time in this hour, these divisions. Then there's queers that are in the movement openly now, which I think that's probably kind of new. It's new altogether for queers to be open about themselves. But now it's come up big time because of what's over there on Countercurrents, and brought the homosexual issue in a major way. And you know, there are white pro-white people who are fine with that. Doesn't bother them. And then there's a lot of pro-white people who are absolutely opposed to it. Don't want this to be a part of the white group. And so there, that's another one that's come up. That, you know, people would say, oh, we can ignore it. I don't, when it comes up as big as it's come up, I don't think you can ignore it. And you don't want to say anything about that. You don't have to. I can go on to the next two.
Let me say some simple things that might damn me in some people's minds, but I'm more of the live and let live kind when it comes to homosexuality. I think homosexuality is a biological issue that will, it's self-regulating, really. When it gets into politics and who's in charge, I don't want to be led by a flaming queer. That's pretty clear to me. But
how about somebody who's not flaming, but you know he's queer?
Somebody's in the closet and
no, they're not in the closet. They're not so much. Well, kind of in the closet, let's say.
I don't like it. It makes me kind of ill to think about it.
Well, that's what happens. That's why it's being brought in, because it's a destroyer, you know, and it makes people feel kind of sick and ill, and so there can't be good for a healthy white societies or a healthy white movement. In my opinion, but we don't have to continue on that. Then there's the issue of Nazism that some people bring in, you know, like to bring up as, well, we got to get rid of that. Now, how come we have to get rid of all the Nazis, but we don't have to get rid of the queers?
Well, to me, the Nazi thing is more of a marker of crypto-Jews, of people who are more concerned about what's best for the Jews. Because I ran into that an awful lot when I was first starting to wake up and starting to realize what was going on, and that it was the Jews who were really behind it. And the minute, of course, that you identify the Jews as your enemy, as the people who are aggressing against you and your people, you are called a Nazi, whether you're a Nazi or not. I mean, to this day, 5 years later, I really don't understand the finer points of National Socialism or the history. I'm just beginning to get into racial hygiene in the series of installments I'm doing. But I'm basically, at this point, I'm not afraid to be called anything. They can call me whatever name they want. Yeah. And to me, when somebody calls me a name, and especially a name like Nazi or a Jew hater or whatever, anti-Semite, they're only identifying themselves to me as my enemy. And they're either my enemy out of ignorance, they're another white person who is under this brain control that they've just internalized this idea that they've got to protect Jews at all costs because Jews are the canaries in the coal mine of our civilization, and if the Jews get persecuted, the whole society is going to go down the tube soon. That's how they think about it. They're either fools that don't realize that they're being tricked, they're useful idiots, or they're Jews. And they just haven't denounced that they're Jews.
Yeah, it's not so much that kind of Nazism, but actual National Socialist period in our history that so many people relate to and think is a great part of our white history. And then others say, oh, no, we can't use that. That's bad news, and let's just forget about that. It's more like national socialism.
I'm not sympathetic to that argument at all. I'm sympathetic to arguments based on the idea that it maybe isn't practical, that people who aren't German, it's not going to appeal to, it might even turn them off. That it makes sense to me. The argument that we can't say anything about Nazis and we have to denounce the Nazis because otherwise people are turned off, that doesn't make sense to me. And it isn't true, I don't think, because once you explain race and the Jews to people, I think they get the Nazi thing. Even if they're not German, they understand why the Nazis, why the National Socialist Germans did what they did.
You know, and there's such great information that the National Socialists produced during those years. And a lot of people want to use that, while at the same time they want to denounce or say, well, we don't want anything to do with the word Hitler or anything like that. But they use the material, and that kind of irritates me. But I guess that's kind of, well, we did hear our 60-second. Boy, it seems a little early for that to me. The other one is the North-South divide.
Yeah, Yankees versus Southerns, yeah.
Yeah. And that's another real one, you know, particularly for the Southerners. Now, the Southerners want to secede now. And then you mentioned the Irish, English, and the German Slav. Those are not so major, but they can be among certain people. So we have a lot of differences that we start fighting among ourselves. And that's the point of this little discussion here. And instead of, I'm certainly a participate in it. But instead of showing this united front, and for me, I think, well, we'll never reach a united front. I don't think we're capable of it.
We need to recognize our common enemy. That will help us unite.
Okay, well, we'll get into that in the second hour. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. There's more to come.
Dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Von einer Zeit für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, Du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour on December 3rd, 2012. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and with me is Tan Stoffel of the White Network and ageoftreason.blogspot.com. And we kind of went, I'd like for us to get in this second hour, Tan, I'd like for us to get into the White Network and our progress report, so to speak. It's not really a progress report, so to speak. I mean, exactly, but it is to talk about some of the things that have been going on there and to, again, discuss how what we want to do fits into what we're actually doing and so on. And I've got quite a few ideas about that. But you had mentioned you were talking in the beginning about your own program, and I will say that I'm real happy with the programs that I do on there. I'm going to get back to the Saturday afternoon program in January, and I hope I'll be able to keep juggling all of this. I would actually like to have another program, a news program, but I realize that I can't. I would be stretching. I cannot stretch myself that thin. And so then we talk about other people coming on, and I was quite anxious to get new programs and other people involved. And we did get two programs in the last 3 months. The first one started on September 19th and the second one on September 29th. The first one, the host was not able to keep doing programs. It was too much for him to do. And then the second one, we had a dispute, about some, these white nationalist issues on the gender. And so that one has ended. And now you had said, well, I should let you say it, but that you're happy enough with just the two of us, well, the three of us with Hadding also. And I thought, oh, gosh, how can you have a network like that? But at the moment, I'm happy with that, too, because I'm kind of worn tired of trying to usher programs. It's really difficult.
Yeah. Well, that was my only ambition from the beginning, was to enable you to continue your show outside of VOR. You didn't want to continue with VOR anymore, and you approached me about doing the technical side and possibly doing a radio program of my own. And that's how I got into it, thinking, okay, I'm just going to do the software. That sounds like an interesting problem, and I want to help Carolyn because I've really enjoyed her Heretics Hour for the last few years. And the fact that that's enabled the International Jew Study Hour and these other shows, even though a couple of them have started and fizzled for the various reasons, I'm happy about that. But it is stressful to try and deal with other people and what their vision is. And there's inevitably going to be conflicts. And I knew that you and I were fairly compatible. I mean, we wouldn't have come together and partnered on this if we didn't both have an understanding that we were somewhat compatible. And so that was risky enough, I thought. And every time we add a show, it's quite stressful trying to negotiate, well, what's it going to be called and what are you going to talk about? And, you know, I didn't want to really impose a set of, you have to do this and you have to do that. But then again, it comes down to, well, we started the network, and if somebody's doing something that you vehemently disagree with, we should have the ability to pull the plug and not to be associated with them anymore. I mean, it goes both ways. If they didn't like what we were saying, that they could pull out at any time.
Yeah, although now someone like Hattie has worked out real well. Of course, we do that program together, and it's got a theme, you know, something to
well,
base everything on.
Hattie's very experienced, and he's got a lot of
knowledge. Although he doesn't want to do a show of his own either, because it's too much work, I think, basically. I mean, he doesn't want to put that much time into it. He thinks about it, but I don't know, right, because of what we've both just said, I'm again happy just with where we are and trying to do these shows of my own. And maybe my idea that if we call something a network, that it should have more on it, you know? I mean, I just never even considered it was just going to be me. And then, then of course I always assumed you were going to do one, although you said you weren't sure. And when we started,
we started, and I did start my show once I thought we were stable enough and the software was pretty much finished that I could start my own show, I actually enjoyed doing it. I had some technical issues initially, and I still feel like kind of stupid because sometimes I talk about things that are fairly basic from a white racialist point of view. But I remind myself that repetition is good, that even talking about simple things is good. It's going to appeal to some people. It's going to educate some people. I'm not trying to please everybody. I'm specifically aiming at a kind of a different, less advanced audience, a less familiar audience with this topic, more introductory or a bridge, to the vast masses of people that aren't used to thinking or hearing these kind of thoughts expressed. That's who I'm aiming at. And your demeanor is good enough that way, that you speak in ordinary terms and, you come at it though from a more advanced, the ideas are more advanced, but your demeanor and your presentation is very, general and very broad. So, I'm happy with that aspect of the network. I there's a part of me that also thinks the white network, well, that should be, we should just have oodles of white people doing different shows on different aspects. And we made that call for shows on white culture and various aspects of implicit white identity. And no one has come forward to fill that vacuum. And again, it goes back, I think, to the problem of there aren't all that many of us. And that's why we have problems creating organizations and doing things. Differences of opinion come about because mostly it takes nonconformists to do what we do, to break through the politically correct membrane and speak out against the prevailing power structure. And there's not all that many of us, so the differences we do have are sort of magnified by that. If there were more of us, we'd have more camps, and people would maybe clash with some people, but they'd find a critical mass of other people, of like-minded people. And
I've realized that while just as on my own programs, I want only the ideas that I approve of and think are good and useful to be put on there, actually, that I find that I actually feel the same way about the network. We didn't want a big tent to begin with. Well, we wanted we wanted shows that would fit in with what we consider our what we put in our mission statement, so to speak, and what we consider the kind of content that is okay, which is that one of the main things we we agreed on was that there wouldn't be any non-whites, either as hosts or guests or anything.
Yeah.
It would be all white. And that's, I think that we are the only network, and we're not a very much of a network, but, you know, big network. But I think we're the only one that holds to that of anybody or any shows. I think we're the only radio shows that, internet radio shows that hold to that, although there might be some, I'm thinking of, all of a sudden Tom Metzger came to my mind again. He does programs, and I don't know what he puts on there. Probably follows that pretty well. But, he just has his own thing. And a lot of people just put on their own show.
Yeah.
So I'm like now, if it's not going to fit, if shows are not going to, if a person's going to do a show on the White Network, this is going to sound terrible. And they want to eventually just say whatever they think should be said. And it doesn't fit. Well, you already said this, I guess. Doesn't fit what we think. Then we don't really want that going on there.
Yeah.
So that's pretty restrictive, isn't it? I guess we're kind of elitist.
It is, and let me throw you under the bus that you're actually more selective than I am. As long as it's pro-white and explicitly anti-Jewish, or at least recognizes that Jews aren't white, then I'm okay with it. And
I'm more fussy about it.
You are more selective. Yeah.
Yeah, selective is a nice word, Dan. as we're saying this, I want to make a correction because several people have talked about this video that Mike Delaney has put out on the Alexa ratings, and I found out that when you helped me to figure this out, that the rating that he gave me was for CarolynYeager.com. And my rating for Carolyn Yeager, there's two ratings for me, CarolynYeager.net. They shouldn't be that way, but somehow it's turned out that way, and they've got separated. And there's a CarolynYeager.net and a CarolynYeager.com. And my Alexa rating at CarolynYeager.net is 536,000. Well, today it was 536,841. So it was ahead of Tom Metzger. Here is Tom Metzger again. And but below Ted Pike.
Above the White Network, which.
I have a more
mention.
Traffic. No, he didn't even mention the White Network. He may not have. He may not think in terms of that. He may not even hardly be aware of it, as far as I know. Maybe I'll have to write to him and start communicating to him if I can find out his email address. But he. I know how I can find it out. But if I put those two together, then I might be closer to Ted Pike than I am now. But I mean, this is, so I have good traffic at that site. And the White Network has pretty good traffic for being so new. The White Network was 600 and some thousands. And that is...
I think that reflects that...
Ahead of Ramsey Paul in VOR and White Rabbit. Right, White Rabbit was... pretty far back there.
I think the White Network is benefiting from the link from you, that from your Carolyn Yeager sites. That's how it works. This Alexa stuff is based on incoming links, and it's basically it's very similar
that.
To Google's PageRank, where they rate domains based on what other domains are pointing to them and what their rank is. It's sort of a circular definition. In fact,
yeah,
they have to.
So how important do you think these ratings are? How important? Relevant are they?
They're relevant in that they give some indication as to the size of the audience that you're reaching and the relative importance of these different sites. One of the points that Delaney made that I wanted to comment on was about Nathaniel Kapner's site. What's it called? RealJewNews.com is ranked so high. It outranks the ADL, but it's sort of that kind of stuff turns me off. He creeps me out, brother Kapner. Whereas there are other white nationalists who think, oh, it's great. And Delaney talked a bit about that and how when you're first starting out criticizing Jews, you want to point to these other Jews that are criticizing Jews and say, look, you see, these guys are saying it. It's okay that I also do it. And eventually you graduate to realize you don't need Jews to back you up in criticizing Jews. It kind of defeats the purpose. It subverts, in fact, your your understanding of the issue if you're constantly pointing to Jews.
That's right. I absolutely agree with that. Now, didn't Mike Delaney say that very thing?
Yes, he did. Yeah. I wanted to praise that and okay. echo that point that he makes about that. But that's one of the things that comes out of this ranking. And I think it reflects reality to the extent that he has through a promotion elevated himself to that level. What are some of the other sites? He comes very close to VNN and the ADL. He's sandwiched in between those two in Alexa rating. He's popular. That's a measure of his popularity. And all of these other sites, Ramsey Paul and these other things that you might think are popular are actually, you know, down much, much lower.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go on to programming. Okay, white programming. So many people want entertainment. You know, I mean, they want something to listen to. I mean, I've always wanted something to listen to. And if it's entertaining, well, you appreciate that. Sometimes it's good when it's real heavy. Sometimes it's good when it isn't, although I'm not too much for entertainment anymore. But often I feel that there's a dearth of something to listen to. So I know people are disappointed that we don't have these two shows anymore, although the first one was not our fault. We tried to keep it going, but it didn't. And would just like something on. And so my fussiness, you know, about what the content is, they probably think, you know, that they don't like that. But what are we trying to do? You know, I always think that we're not trying to just entertain people. And there's a lot of that going on in radio programming. We're trying to educate people. And I guess I'm an old school teacher type person, but I'm so focused on wanting to educate and put out the information that people need to have and learn more of it myself. You know, of course, I like to talk about things that I'm interested in, and I keep learning more. I'm excited about some stuff now that I was talking about before the show, but I'm not going to bring that up here. But, we need to get serious, and we spend so much time. There's a lot of, I think you addressed this saying that slowly people pick up on it and they get it as at their own pace. And maybe I'm trying to force people to accept things that they either not interested in at the moment or they're not ready for. And I'm too much that way. Maybe I'm too much that way.
That's right. I don't think we can, force people to see things our way. We have to put it out there, and they will come to see in our way eventually, hopefully, most of them. But a lot of them won't. And as the more you try to force their face in it, the more they'll, I think, be repulsed by it, and our efforts will go to waste. We'd be better served by putting our efforts into producing more material, more education, more conversation from a pro-white point of view.
Well, I'm also aware, too much maybe, or not too much, of what the enemy is doing and how fast they're working to do us in. This is why I don't think we have all this time to wait for people to slowly, you know, catch on.
Well, by talking about what the enemy is doing, though, first of all, you identify that there is an enemy, and identifying what they're doing is going to help wake people up to the threat and the other, the fact that there is a war going on, and that whether they're interested in it or not, the war is interested in them. It's going to affect them. That's partly the realization that many white people are coming to grapple with in the wake of the 2012 election and the way it was described in racial terms. That they understand now that their country is being taken away from them in real terms, not just the Tea Party, we want our country back, and not even understanding who they want it back from, not being too afraid to say who it is, who they are, and who they want to take their country back from, who took it from them. They're starting to grapple with that, who it is and who they are. And I mean, that's the process I went through. I'm projecting a little bit here, my own the process that I went through. But I think while I don't have the arrogance to think that everybody is going to follow the same path I did, I'm sure that there are other people thinking in the same terms that I am. Hey, something's wrong. I'm going to look into what it is. I'm going to try and figure it out. And that's why some of the work that you've done in the past of in the educational vein of talking about disinformation, misinformation, these other competitive, high-ranked sites like Veterans Today, which Mike on Mike Blinney's list is toward the top. It's important to pick at those people, to criticize those people, to pay attention to what they're saying and say, this is what they said, but this is how it's distorted from the truth. This is how they're misleading you, because that helps people see. They're, not everybody understands that they're being misled. That's why fraud is a perennial problem. It's not that people are just stupid and idiots. Everybody is stupid in some sense. Everybody falls for some trick or another. And especially since these are our people, we need to help them to see the tricks that are played on them. And by showing people the tricks and how they work, spelling it out in detail, that helps them then to figure it out and do it themselves. And I understand why educational programming, especially for old hands, seems so useless, because they already understand it. It's boring to them. They'd rather go with the entertainment stuff. They'd rather hear a bunch of white guys throwing racial slurs back and forth and yucking it up, because they've already got the education. They already know the score. But for the vast bulk of our people, they don't know the score yet, and they need it explained to them in sober terms, spelled out, basically, just like you'd have to spell out any fraud. You know, how did the bubble bursting, the banking fraud happen? Well, you need somebody to spell out the details of who benefited and who got ripped off. And almost everybody understands that something bad happened and that there was, you know, the economy suffered. But as far as the mechanics of the details of who did what to who, that is where you need some explication. Somebody, and there are all sorts of, this is the other problem, we're competing with a whole bunch of other people that are throwing out misinformation, disinformation. Lots of Jews are trying to come up with alternative explanations that don't involve the Jews. You see that with 9/11. You see that with race. They want to talk about anything but the Jews, anything but race, and transfer it into purely economic or class terms, or purely left versus right in politics.
Well, I've got some examples of that I want to come up with. But before I do, let me just throw in here that we are still open to new shows. I am open to new shows on the White Network. And I hope that some will develop something, you know, really good. I mean, it's not that I'm now saying, well, I've had it now. I don't want any.
Well, and let me add
but, we're open. So anybody wants to approach us with it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let me add that the person who is thinking about doing it needs to be really confident that they can do it, because it is hard to week after week come up with something that's interesting and that you can talk intelligently about. I can say from personal experience, and I only do a half an hour a week, that it's a difficult thing. And you have to be committed ahead of time to do it. And you have to be somewhat decisive about what you want it to be, too. Please don't look to us for guidance and help in that respect. We'll provide the platform, but you've got to, you know, bring the content and the fire. You've got to have the fire.
Yeah, and a lot of people who do this they're already doing a show somewhere. They've got their own thing going. Like somebody, I'll bring this up. Somebody wrote to me, a listener, and said that he didn't mind that last show was gone, but he said people I would like to hear on the White Network: David Duke, Sword Brethren, and he's talking about shows. He says guy with the Swedish name, he couldn't think of it. I'm thinking maybe he means Severus or Henrik Holappa, maybe, who I've had as guests. Mike Delaney, Bill Fink, and lots more. Professor McDonald. Well, Professor McDonald would be an interview, but he says, I'm sure there are lots of interesting people you could find to replace what you had. Well, these people aren't going to do a show on the White Network. They've got their own shows on their own places.
They've already got outlets.
So people don't understand that. They sort of think that because they like David Duke, well, maybe we can get David Duke on here.
Well, to be fair, maybe that's all he was doing, was giving you a list of people like this is who I mean, as examples, not as...
Okay, well, these are people with a lot of experience, and so I would say, you folks send them our way, just like when somebody wrote in and said, well, I think you should do a show like the Friday show at VOR, and I did write the comment back and said, hey, that's just the idea that we have, and we're trying to put one together. And we'd love to have a Friday show, a news show, but we couldn't get it put together. And now we're further away from that than ever. So you see, these things are not, you need the people. So there's a lot of people who want to be listeners, but not as many people who want to do the shows. And let me say we do have recognize our the people who donate to the White Network, and I keep a list of it, and I keep it all separate, you know, what the donation is going for and so on. And the White Network donations total $440 since we started 6 months ago from 13 different individuals.
That's
kind of good. Yeah, you think it's wonderful.
I want to thank those people as well. Thank you very
good.
Much.
And I know you do. But a lot of other networks would say, God, you know, we couldn't manage on that. You know, that's terrible. But we think it's pretty good, and we're grateful for it. And
neither of us can make a living at that. Neither of us can put food on our table for that. We weren't really looking for that. But at least it covers our computing costs, and that's good.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the other thing then that I want to go to from what you were saying about, how I was going to segue into this, but I'll just say that I went to the Caucasian Persuasion yesterday and today, and which used to be called the White Voice, and the radio program was still called the White Voice. No, it's called Save White People. I don't know if there's still a Save White People, but there's the Caucasian Persuasion, and it's Joe Adams, and he has a very good radio voice, and he's really able to talk well. I'm very impressed with that. But there has been an awful lot of change over there, and that's fairly new, but they've had some people there that are gone, and now it's just basically Joe, and now he had his program number 80, which he had, I guess, been advertising as being real important. And I listened to it, and he had some good stuff in there, but he said that it was going to be his last radio program. And they are changing to something else. They're digitizing their website or something, and they've got all kinds of plans, but now you're supposed to pay $5 a month, you know, and so it's everybody starts out, and then they do tend to make a lot of changes. Things don't go as they planned, but people don't get along. See, he had John DeNugent and Michael Walsh as part of his coming on with special segments of his show, and then they broke up. And I think it's over the Nazism issue. I don't know, but that's what I would suspect, because these are both pro-National Socialist, and Joe is now coming across as very anti-National Socialist and anything like that. And in fact, he came out with this 5-point plan. He just unveiled it on November 30th, a few days ago. And in that, he makes a few statements that I wrote down. One is, don't use racial adjectives like Jew, media, or black crime. You know, I think that's pretty mild, Jew, media, and black crime. But he doesn't want to use those words.
Yeah, that seems wrong-headed to me. Let's just call things what they are. To go back to Mike Delaney liked a euphemism, the Chosenites. He liked, instead of saying Jew, he was saying Chosenite this and Chosenite that. And that turns me off. I mean, I know that Jew can be repetitive, and it sort of grates on most people's ears who aren't used to hearing it. But it's the word that the Jews themselves use. I mean, if we can't say Jew this or Jew that, then we might as well not talk if we have to make up euphemisms or talk.
That's right.
Around
some people overdo it. It's true. Some people overdo the Jew thing, and it is wrong. And I mean, it is grating, and it does turn you off. But to say that we shouldn't use it is really going too far, I think. And that's just another example of where people are pulling back. I don't know why they get out there for a while and they're not making the progress they want to make. Maybe they want a bigger audience. You know, I think they're redoing things in order to get a bigger audience. And so many of these networks, websites and so on, are really into big audiences like, even Mike Delaney looking at the Alexis ratings, you know, to see who's biggest. And when you get to the biggest ones, the most popular ones, they're the most weak ones. You've got Rents, you know, and Drudge. I don't know.
No, I agree with you. That's one of the...
Russia Today, InfoWars.
That's one of the major points that you and I agree on, that I'd rather be accurate about the way that I talk about. I'm laying it out as simple and as clearly as I can based on the way I understand things work. And I'm not trying to create euphemisms or talk around issues. I'm trying to face them as squarely as I can. I think that's what it's going to take. I realize, though, that a lot of people can't do that, and other people have other priorities. In fact, that was one of the reasons why you run Happy at Voice of Reason. I don't know if you want to get into that, but you know, it was partly because Voice of Reason wasn't explicitly pro-white and wasn't explicitly excluding Jews from having a voice. And that's a valid concern that I share with you.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're not ever going to be big. I mean, that's not possible.
I hope we are. Look, the National Socialists, I think, faced the same hurdles. They weren't successful right off the bat, and they struggled for a long time. But ultimately, people came to see that their message was true.
Well, yeah, that's right. But then people will say right after that, Tan, well, look what happened to them.
Did happen to them? Did they destroy Europe as we're led to believe? And this is what the value of August's program was, the road he was going to go down, I thought, was he would be talking about how, you know, that we've been sold a bill of goods about World War II. And that's part of my understanding, too, of the Jewish narrative, is that everything bad that happened during the past is Europeans' fault. And in particular about World War II, everything bad that happened was the Nazis' fault. But then that got broadened. Over time, it got broadened to it's the Germans' fault. And then it got broadened even more than that. It's the Europeans' fault for not stopping the Germans sooner. And, of course, it was the Americans' fault for not intervening.
Yeah, well, that's how the Jews operate. See, that's a perfect example.
This is the
Jewish
narrative.
How the Jews operate. And if you go along with them on one side, they're going to just keep taking you further and further.
That's right. But it's absurd. You know, just from an objective point of view, whether you know anything about National Socialism or not, the idea that the Jews are completely blameless and on the flip side of that coin, that the National Socialists are the ones to blame for everything or racists, however you want to put it. You know, today it's white racists that are to blame for everything. It's absurd. It couldn't possibly be that lopsided one way or the other.
And yeah, so another thing on this – well, go ahead. You had one more thing.
Well, yeah, the point is about actually, that's one of the things that the Jews do much better than us is they are able to be totally lopsided in their own favor, whereas white people, Aryans, tend to be more fair-minded or at least more objective thinking, more able to see both sides. They may still have a partisanship to them in their mindset, but tend to, and I do it myself all the time. When I'm describing a lot of these things, I describe it in very objective terms.
Balanced.
That, yeah, Jews, while they're able to see both sides, they fiercely, fiercely defend their own side. If they perceive that one of those two sides is good for the Jews and one is bad, they won't even think twice about taking the bad Jew side. That's just evil and wrong, and they will fight it tooth and nail. And our weakness compared to them is that we are too seduced by seeing things in an objective way.
Well, I agree with that 100%. And I think we have to learn to change that, or at least we have to have a core of people who will do that and be very nasty and hard-headed and let the rest of them and, you know, take care of the rest of them who are still going to be the fair-minded white people that they are. But they have to recognize who their enemy is, though. They do have to do that. We all have to do that. So now, but it seems as though this Caucasian persuasion site is pulling back from the Jews, and I don't quite understand it because, or from talking about Jews, because I think it's a creator. I think, you know, it's Ben Klassen, creator from philosophy. And that was totally anti-Jewish and also anti-Christian. And, but they seem to be pulling back to save white people. They say you have to reach all the white people where they are. And if you're using the word, certain words like Jew and black, they're going to be turned off and they won't listen to you. This is the same argument at VOR that was at VOR. And by the way, we have the hoped for return of VOR. I would like to see it return, although I would probably be very critical of it if it goes along the way that it was going to go. So, there you go. But still, but we have a lot of this media that is going this direction, that are saying, well, we need to be careful what we say so we can reach out to these people. Well, maybe because of, maybe it goes back to the election, because he was talking about the election too and said he watched a ton of Fox News during the election campaign. I thought, well, great, good for you. The white people are ready to hear something and we have to be careful how we talk to them if we want to reach them. And the other thing was that, don't look to the past for answers. He said he made a big point of that in one of his 5 points. And of course they're critical of not anything to do with Nazis and Nazism. So that's another thing. So this is goes just the opposite direction that I think, we need to go in, and somebody needs to be going in this way.
Yeah. Well, you touched on it too when you, criticized the Holocaust issue that came up at Countercurrents about stepping over the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the point there I agree with is that we're going to be confronted with it anyway. And, we have to be ready to deal with it. We have to be ready to argue it. And I think beyond that, we ought to argue it. I've taken to, when I talk to ordinary friends and neighbors about immigration, I describe it in terms of, the Holocaust. You know, I say, it's payback for the Holocaust. And I know that that probably drives anyone who understands what the Holocaust really is, this narrative of the Jews, that it's mostly made up, their suffering greatly exaggerated, that it frustrates them to even hear the term used in its literal or as if it's for real. But when you talk to ordinary people, that's all they know. And by putting it in those terms, they're not used to hearing that, that immigration is payback. Oh, you mean all these Mexicans that are here? This is payback for the Holocaust. I've never thought about that before. And it puts them back on their heels. And then you say, well, yeah, of course, look at the rhetoric around immigration. Anytime anybody wants to restrict immigration, look at Arizona. You know, the terms that they're attacked or pathologized and demonized in is in Jewish terms, in terms of Nazis, of you're going to ask for their papers. Oh my God! You know, the next thing you'll be doing is loading them in boxcars and sending them off to concentration camps. It's part of our political discourse, or it is our political discourse today, is thoroughly Judaized, and the whole Nazi Holocaust terms. They don't themselves, because they don't. It's not productive for them to beat people over the head with the Nazis, just in the same way that it's not all that productive for us to beat people over the head with Jews. They do it in subtle ways. So they'll talk about gas chambers or cattle cars or concentration camps or make even more veiled references. But everybody, once you point it out, it becomes pretty obvious to people. And that's all you need to do is plant that seed in a person's head. And they walk away from you thinking, well, that guy, he's a bit strange. The Holocaust, what does that have to do with immigration? But then they go home and they turn on CNN and they hear some Jew commentator who they never thought of as a Jew before talking about boxcars and concentration camps and asking for papers and how horrible that is. And they go, oh, my God, yeah, what he said was right. And they start to see for themselves. And once they realize it for themselves, I don't care if they give me credit for – I don't care if they even remember that I was the one who told it to them, as long as they start thinking correctly and start seeing clearly what's going on and who's doing it.
Well, that's why I think it's absolutely crucial that we be pointing out what is being done, how we're being fooled, how this narrative keeps going and keeps building. And it is not based on truth. It's not based on anything that's good for us. This needs to be pointed out to people. I don't know the best. Maybe I don't have the best way to talk to people, but it's the only way I can talk to them. And so that's what I do. Well, we got this story here that I think I sent it to you, but I don't know if it's in your mind or not. But just a good example in, of course, the good old Hungarians. I like what the Hungarians are trying so hard. And the Jews are just, you know, going after them. And now this Jobbik party, this man in the Jobbik party, he's a official of some kind. I forget. But he was, somebody's calling. Yeah, okay, answer the phone. Yeah, he made a comment that the Hungarian government needed to make a list of all the Jews in the government, of all the Jews in Hungary, but especially those in the parliament and the government. And I thought that was just great. I mean, this is what should be done. We should be able to say this here in the United States. We need to identify, he said. They needed to do a survey to identify all Hungarians of Jewish descent, especially those in parliament and the government. They have such a problem with Jews there. Well, why not? Why shouldn't we identify those of Jewish descent in parliament and in our Congress and government and so on? Because he says they have this shameful pro-Israel bias. What happened to the caller? He disappeared?
Yeah, I wasn't able to get through an answer soon enough. I'm having trouble with my chat.
Well, he's supposed to hang on.
I see it now. All right. Yeah, if the caller, if you'll call in again, hopefully I can answer sooner.
Okay. So he says, so the Jews, of course, got all excited, but he said that all that these, later he said, well, what he meant was, because he had to apologize, and he didn't want to apologize. So he said that what he really meant was that many Hungarian, well, that many people, oh, this guy, forget it. I think now is the right time in connection with such a conflict to count how many people of Jewish descent there are here, and especially in parliament, who pose a security risk to Hungary. No, I'm all mixed up now. But he said because they were dual citizens, you know. And at least you should identify people in your country that are dual citizens, particularly those who participate in government or in Congress or something like that.
Yeah, who have power of some sort or another. Yeah, that's just common sense. It always has been, and certainly the Jews insist on that in their own country. They want the Palestinians that live within their borders to take loyalty oaths and explicitly accept that Israel is a Jewish state. But that's part of their hypocrisy when it comes to nationalism. You know, they want it for themselves, and they don't want it for anyone else. They want to be free to roam about the globe doing what's best for the Jews wherever they can, and they fiercely defend that any place they feel it's even slightly impinged or that they're recognized as Jews and being separate from the people of that country, that they pounce and they punish anybody who is stands out and is against them.
Well, we should maybe talk like that. I mean, I don't think that's going too far.
Oh, here we have this call coming in again. Let me see if I can get this. Oh, it disappeared again. I've got to make this into some sort of a button pushing thing where you can just click instead of having to type the call.
Yeah.
ID. Sorry, well, caller. Try again. I'm not ignoring you on purpose.
Okay, now, is there something, while I'm looking around here, is there something more that you wanted to, that you thought was important to say?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about the feedback to my show and the kind that I like and the kind that I don't like. I don't get very much, but I did get a comment during the Who's White series of installments from somebody who was very upset and frankly insulted me by saying that my show was a waste of space.
Yeah, I remember
and,
that.
And recommended people listen to other shows, and but I tried to have a thick skin about it, and he actually was constructive in his criticism in that he linked to a David Lane piece about Who is White, the exact topic that I was talking about, and I appreciated that. I had run into that piece myself in the distant past, and it wasn't on my mind, but I was glad he brought it up because I think David Lane made some good points about Who is White and, you know, the thrust of it being, you know, the people who are fighting for white people are the whitest of us all. There's a sense of defining white in those terms and those terms alone. And I differ from David Lane. And here's
okay,
that
there's
call.
That
let's,
caller
let's see
again.
If I can grab it fast enough here. It's 1532. Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
Is this the White Network?
Hey,
you need to
turn your
sound down.
Yeah, you've got something going in the background there that we can hear.
Yeah, I turned it off.
Okay. You have a question?
Hi, what's your name?
Yeah, this is Don from California.
Hi, Don.
Hi, Don. I recognize you.
Yeah, thank you. I had a couple of comments. First of all, congratulations on establishing a network and the progress that you've made. Shows are very good. Both of you do great work. One comment I wanted to make in the aftermath of the election is that I was listening to some of the talk radio, and one of the mainstream conservative guys out here, Hugh Hewitt, did a show, and he had some media consultants on, and they were talking about why Romney crashed and burned. And they said, well, he spent too much money on TV. And one of the consultants said, and I quote, "No one is watching TV anymore." Also, there's a computer guy we have on talk radio out here. He's syndicated on the weekends, named Leo Laporte. I guess he's on all over the country. And he doesn't talk about politics per se, but he talks a lot about the Internet. He says his kids, they never watch TV. They're on the Internet all the time. And I think, and the point I am making is that Internet broadcasting, such as what you do, I think the ratings and the numbers of people is a little misleading, because it's not so much how many people listen, but who are the people? Are they thinkers and doers, or are they dead wood? They tend to be more intense people. If I wrote a book, I'd rather sell 1,000 copies to 1,000 very important shakers and movers than 10,000 of people that are just going to read it while they're sitting in, you know, out in the outhouse, passing the time of day, so to speak. And I've noticed that listening to network television and even cable, huge advertisements. I mean, you sit there and you listen to, and even network talk radio, I mean, you got, you know, 10 minutes of news at the top and the bottom of the hour, commercials, traffic, and they're always pushing people to get off the air. And you don't have that on Internet broadcast. You have real information. So I think
what do you think about advertising on these pro-white radio programs and so on? What do you think about some of them that have so much advertising? Well, some of this that I'm saying pro-white, they're not really pro-white. They're just alternative. But the direction is going that more and more people who have been providing free content and just hoping to get people to listen and to come and read their stuff on their websites are now trying to get advertising.
Well, I think advertising is okay, provided it doesn't distract, it doesn't detract from your message.
I think advertising has an effect on your message. It can't help. In fact, even the desire to get advertising, which is, I was talking just a minute ago about wanting to reach a larger audience, which, while it would be great to reach a larger audience, so you just said that a quality is better than quantity, if people Okay, to get advertising, you have to reach a larger audience. You know, you have to get people to pay to advertise on your site for, or say, when you're running on your radio, on your program, your radio program, you have to show that you have a certain amount of listeners or they're not going to do it. See? So the advertising and that listeners and that reaching a larger audience goes together. And right away,
you can solve that problem, you still have the problem then of you. They become your employer, basically. You don't want to say anything that's going to upset your
that's
advertisers
right.
and cut off your stream of revenue. And that is, even in Henry Ford's day, he was talking about that power in one of your recent shows.
Well, and we know that that's the power of the newspapers. And let me just throw in here real quick. I don't want to stop you from what you were going to say, Tan. But, you know, at this Caucasian Persuasion, when he's saying that they want to get they want to expand and so on. Is what they want to do, and they want to get more results from what they're doing. But at the same time, then they're cutting back on talking about Jews and blacks so much, so openly. So see that's an example of it.
Yeah, I want to thank Don for making those points, though. The one being about the major media, TV in particular, losing its power because people are going elsewhere. They're not happy with what they're getting on television entirely. So for real hard information, they go to the internet. And I think it's true, even more true for newspapers and magazines. I mean, concerns like Newsweek being sold for $1 recently is an interesting phenomenon that those things lose money. And why do they continue? Because they offer something to the owner that he can't get anywhere else, that it's an organ for him to promote his views. And that's why he's willing to pay money to distribute his magazine or newspaper. And it's a good sign, though, that our people are starting to abandon those things and go elsewhere for their information, the Internet.
There's one more point I would like to make. You talked about getting David Duke on your show, and people suggested a bunch of guests. Guests are important, but I think it is important to bring in new talent to get more of our people involved. I really think that's...
Well, I agree with you. I don't think we need to hear the same old people who already have shows, and they're saying the same thing on their shows. And they come on and do it. But
yeah.
This person wasn't talking about guests, and I wasn't. But guests is another issue, though, that's we could discuss. But he was talking about these people having a show. And I was saying people like this with big names who had shows and have their own places to have them are not going to they don't need to come on the White Network, and they wouldn't do it. So you have to be more realistic when you talk about this. But
well,
even as guests, no. I don't even ask David Duke to be on because he doesn't have anything new to say. Sorry.
Well, I think it is important. You know, some people are intimidated about broadcasting. They don't think they have the skill or they don't speak well enough. Or you know, if I want to hear fancy, smooth talking BS, I'll turn on Rush Limbaugh. I mean, I'm sick of that. What people want to hear is something that is honest and brave and forthright. You don't need whistles and bells. You know, you really don't. And
I have to disagree with you about Rush Limbaugh. He's not even smooth or anything like that. I've been actually listening to Rush Limbaugh when I'm in my car in the afternoons at the time that he's on, because he's on like for 3 hours. And I hear bits and pieces and so on. And, you know, with all the help he's got and all that big staff there behind the glass that he talks to and talks about and whatever during his show, and all the people who are preparing material for him for his show, there's got to be a few anyway, he's not that good. He drags things out. He talks about, he has one little thing to talk about and he drags it out through several commercial breaks, you know. But people are used to, they just want to hear that noise in the background, something they're familiar with. They don't learn much from it.
Well, he has a very professional presentation. He's got a lot of satire and a lot of entertainment, and he's got 20 million listeners. But
I know he's got 20 million listeners, but I don't hear the satire or such clever entertainment. But anyway.
Frankly, I find him rather tiresome. Well, I'll conclude with that. Just close by saying congratulations again and keep up the good work, and hopefully we'll be collaborating
on
something.
Yeah, why don't you stay on, Don, until the end of the show, even if you don't say anything?
Yeah,
because
thanks,
if you hang up, we might not hear our closing music.
Oh, okay.
That'd be better if we do hear it. So
I wanted to continue about the kind of criticism that I've gotten, the feedback that I've gotten. I've gotten some helpful feedback from listeners who have made points for via private email to me, and I've incorporated that into some shows. But the one I got from Christopher about David Lane, I thought that was great, even though it was a little hard for me to swallow somebody saying, listen to something else. I thought I reacted well to it, and I learned something myself, and I hope I shared something with people, too, that edified them. But this recent point that Carl has been making, and I know Carl is a frequent commenter on our site, but frankly, what he had to say was kind of demoralizing to me. And that was his point about, you've got to have deep knowledge, and you can't be sounding like you're just learning your
topic.
Well,
I don't think he was meant you.
Well, I took it as
his
fee was talking about me, because he was describing what at least some of my shows have been, which is I'm learning the stuff myself, and I'm trying to share what I'm learning. And the reason it's demoralizing is because I think one of the things that, and Don just touched on it, is we don't all have to have a PhD in order to be qualified to talk in favor of our people and to advocate for our interests. And that is part of our problem, is people feel intimidated. It's part of this stupid, crazy, evil attack that's used against us. There's already suggestion out there that in order to defend white people, in order to advocate for white interests, you are either stupid or you're crazy or you're just plain evil. And people have internalized that, and it puts a real crimp. It really discourages people from speaking out. And it would be better for us if people could overcome that and not feel like they have to have a PhD in Jewology to say something critical about the Jews, or in favor of white people, that they don't have to understand where we came from exactly and all of the stuff that I've dug into. And I would hope people are encouraged to speak out more and not be discouraged.
Yeah, I don't consider myself very professional at all. Sometimes I'm really embarrassed. It's the way some parts of my show go. And I think Carl was setting too high of a standard there in what he was writing. It would be nice, but, he was trying to say something.
Well, he was listing some good criteria, I think, for an ideal host. But what we need right now is not necessarily ideal. If they were there, they'd be on the air with us. We could use just some ordinary people, too, some ordinary white people speaking up.
Yeah, because there are people who have the courage and are like to talk and – and that's the most important part, in a sense. But you do have to be kind of careful what you say. But we're not that careful.
Our problem is not that what we're saying is not right enough or not perfect enough. That's, I guess, one of my bugaboos, that we shouldn't be so worried about having to be perfect or perfectly correct.
No, well, we're not perfect. And, Tan, I want to thank you for being on the show tonight. I wish you could be on more often. And you know that. But, well, ladies and gentlemen, we've tried to present something about our network and keep up to date with y'all. And we'll probably do this 3 months from now. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.